I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Write what you know is the old adage, the advice that writers often get. Our guest, Elizabeth Laban, has done just that in her new novel, The Restaurant Critic's Wife. She's the real-life wife of Philadelphia Inquirer restaurant critic Craig Laban. The book is about Lila and Sam Soto, who have moved from New Orleans to Philadelphia, where Sam is the new restaurant critic for the Philadelphia Herald. Lila has quit her job to raise their children in Center City while Sam is establishing himself as a critic. While being married to a restaurant critic may sound like a lot of fun and a lot of good food, it does come with a price. Sam's determination to be anonymous has left Lila feeling alone. This is Elizabeth Laban's third book, her first adult novel, and she joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Congratulations on your latest book.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you with us as well, and I'd love to have you read from the very beginning of your book, and each chapter begins with a restaurant review by Sam Soto.
It does. So I'll begin. Chapter 1. Something is rotten at Via Rizzo. It's not necessarily the food, which was tasty, though often inconsistent. It's a false advertising. The menu claims that the pasta sauce is crafted from an old family recipe, when in fact it is factory made. It went down easy enough. My wife finished her plate, but I knew better, and the chef didn't deny it. "Why lie?" I asked him in a phone interview. "People don't want the truth," he said. "They want an illusion of romance. It tastes better." Sam Soto. I am standing in a dark alley behind a restaurant. One hand rests on my pregnant belly and the other shields my nose from the smell of rotting food. I watch as my husband disappears into a dumpster. I hear him push garbage around. The odor gets stronger. I put my other hand up to my nose and hold my breath. "I found them," Sam finally says in a loud whisper. His bushy hair emerges, followed by the rest of his head. He looks at us with bright, dark eyes, then flashes his know-it-all grin. He reminds me of a ferret who just snared its prey. That chef is lying. I glance at my mother and her old friend Elaine, our dinner guests, waiting impatiently on the sidewalk. My mother pats Elaine's light pink cashmere sleeve as I straighten my arms, still trying not to breathe, and offer them a weak smile. I can't believe this is happening. 2 hours ago, I imagined we would have a smooth evening at Via Rizzo, one of the trendy new restaurants in Philadelphia's Avenue of the Arts. When we walked in, my mother smiled warmly at the creamy marble floor and the crystal chandeliers. She nodded politely to the two trickling fountains that greeted us at the entrance to the dining room. She practically sighed with relief when she saw the well-dressed waiters. At first, I wanted to ask if she had worried that we would take her and Elaine to a dump. Little did I know we'd end up at one.
That's our guest, Elizabeth Laban, reading from the very beginning of her new book called The Restaurant Critic's Wife. And I think with a title like that, you're going to get a lot of questions, which is what is fact and what is fiction? So let's take care of some of this stuff.
Okay.
Did your husband, Craig Laban, ever dumpster dive after going to a restaurant?
No. That's funny. That's probably the most asked question I've gotten so far. He's done some crazy things, but he has not done that. No.
And why did you pick that title? Only because it is who you are.
It's true.
It is who you are.
That was always my working title. And actually, when the publisher bought the book, that was one of the things she wanted to talk about changing. And we went through a lot of different titles, some of which we laugh about because they're funny, but I don't think that they really, you know, gave a good sense of the book. So she finally agreed, the editor and the publisher finally agreed, okay, we'll stick with this. And it's what I always hoped for. And I think you can't, you know, give this book a better title.
What were some of the other titles that got rejected?
Well, they're almost silly, but Love Under the Cherry Tree, because there's a cherry tree on the street where Lila and Sam live. And that plays a big part in the book, as far as Lila's transition. Baking a Cake of Love was another one.
I think I like the restaurant critic's wife.
I don't think that they ever would have gone with one of those. We were sort of brainstorming, and those are the ones that we laugh about.
This has been a long time, as I understand it, coming. And you're, I think, more known for writing books for young adults. This is a book for adults.
Yes. So this is the first novel I ever tried to write, and this novel has been in the works for years.
Like decades, years?
No, so my son now is 14, and I really started writing when he was an infant and napping. This book, I mean. And it's probably gone through 25 solid drafts, changes. Wow. And I don't even just mean a few words here, but even, you know, storylines. This book was always about Sam and Lila. But I did definitely play with different plot choices. And I think at this point it's really almost at its best. And what I really hope to say, pared down to Lila's true story without a lot of unnecessary plot twists.
It's interesting you stayed with it because you hear from novelists, you know, they have this novel that's been sitting in the drawer that they just gave up on, but you didn't give up on this.
No, I didn't. I always loved this book. There were times that I thought it might never happen, that it might never, you know, be out there for people to read. and I really feel that I have to thank my agent for that. I found him with this book. He read an early draft of this book and took me on 10 years ago. It was February 2006.
A very patient agent.
He is a very patient agent. His name is Uwe Stender. And he loved the book and always said, I'll keep trying until, you know, there's no place else to try. Having said that, this draft is much better, I do believe. And that, you know, he always encouraged me to keep going and think about it in different ways and put it to the side and work on another book and then come back to it. So that made a big difference.
This book is about – it's a young couple moving to a new city, the husband, in this case, Sam Soto, establishing himself as a restaurant critic, and Lila essentially raising the family and sort of trying to figure out what she wants to do with the rest of her life. It's also about anonymity, and I've interviewed your husband several times,
I
know that, you know, restaurant critics, he in particular – try to guard their identity so that they can do their job without being discovered.
Right.
But what I get from this book is the kind of anonymity that affects Lila and the children and even the rest of the family, that it has reverberations beyond just the restaurant critic himself.
Right. And I think a few things. I think I beefed up their story, Lila and Sam's story, to make Lila's struggle bigger. Also, Sam is new to Philadelphia in the book, so it really is his chance to not be known. And hopefully, you know, he hopes to hold on to that as long as he can. For us, we've been here a long time, 17 years, and Center City is a strangely small city for such a big city. So it's impossible to remain completely unknown. There's no question about it. But having said that, Craig tries his best. He would never announce himself. That wouldn't make sense to him. And there are many times we slip in unnoticed, because even if people do have a picture, I don't think they're holding it in their hand. And I think if a restaurant's busy, you know, you could easily miss who's coming in and out. So it's always worth it. Other things that I do or that I don't do, I never post pictures of our family online. I've never done that. The kids, yes, and they have their own, you know, Facebook
but you
and Twitter accounts.
But you don't.
Of the kids, I do. Never of Craig. I would never do that. And I don't make reservations in my name. And I have a credit card with my maiden name. So there are things that I still try to do. And also, Craig, I almost never say his name when we're at a meal. Like, I'm just in the habit of not saying Craig.
Do you have a special code name?
No, I just don't even say anything. I mean, I just, you know, he knows I'm talking to him. So I realize how rarely I actually say his name. And when we're at home, I do. It's not. But at a meal,
in public.
Yeah, I'm not, you know, screaming across the table to him.
Well, Sam is, I mean, shall we say obsessed? Maybe
yes,
even a
I
little
think that's
paranoid about being discovered, his identity. And I have to say, the first time, I think it was the first time I interviewed your husband, Craig LeBan, he came into this building with a box on his head.
I remember
that. And we had to actually cover some of the windows. So that
that was nice of you to do that.
We
for him.
Did do that. But I felt like it's almost like, you know, someone is in the witness protection program and we have to protect their identity.
And that was early on, right? So
it was very early
on. He was
on.
Sort of closer to where Sam is. Not that he's ever been as obsessive as Sam is, but closer to that hope to sort of hold on to that, you know, not being recognized as long as he could. So, yeah, but I do remember that moment.
In this story, they are newly moved to Philadelphia. And he asks, Sam asks Lila, look, I don't want you to work.
Yeah.
Or he sort of, he doesn't demand it, but he asks it of her.
He does. And partly it's because Lila's job up to that point is with a big restaurant and resort, an international restaurant and resort company, and she manages the crises that they deal with, and often finds herself in the news. So that's one of the reasons that he asks her to not be out there. And also, he doesn't want her meeting so many people. He's so nervous, and he doesn't trust anybody. He, in his mind, he thinks everyone owns a restaurant or is hoping to be a chef. So that's sort of where he's coming from. And also, they have these two little kids. I mean, when the book begins, they have a 3-year-old, and she's about to have the second baby.
Right.
So in his mind, I think he thinks we'll get settled and, you know, you'll stay home and not meet anyone.
In this novel, Lila, she's a crisis manager. That's her job, is putting out, you know, fires, not literal fires.
Right.
Is that something you'd be good at? Do you have the kind of skills for that?
I think
you said,
I would be terrible at that.
Why?
I'm a big worrier, and I love the idea of it, and I think that's why I had so much fun writing Lila's character. And I love hotels, so I loved writing her in scenes where she could be in a hotel. There's one moment in the book when she goes to a hotel and she stops and sort of breathes in the hotel smell the way someone might smell the ocean air.
Right.
And I just love that moment. So, because it just shows how much she loves the hotels.
And why do you love hotels?
I don't know. I think they're an escape, and I could spend hours, you know, looking up hotels if we think we're going somewhere. I love that. So to write the hotels was a fun part of it. But I would be a terrible crisis manager. There are moments in the book when we see Lila in action. She almost is surprised that she has this moment and she still has it in her. And I love that. But I would not be able to do that.
There's some scenes of Lila and Sam and sometimes others going out for dinner. And I've done that with your husband, Craig Leban, about sort of how do you eat when there's a food critic amongst you?
Right, right. And you just do. I mean, it's funny because, he's paying attention to the food and he does it very subtly. But he's not, in the way that Sam isn't present at this first meal, it's exaggerated, but Craig is certainly focused on what he's doing. I'm not mad. I don't find it offensive. We're so used to it. And I think most people who he does, bring along for a review meal certainly understand.
He's working.
He's working, yeah. But he has a certain way of doing it, and he wants to taste as much of the menu as he can, certainly. And he does that by having people order different things. But it's a surprisingly normal meal, I think. Or maybe I'm just so used to it. But it's
How much do you do it now?
Well, so now I probably go, 2, 3, 4 times a month. Our kids are older now, so it's easier to leave them. But still, he has a lot of people he wants to take, and I can always say I really want to go to that place, and I'll go. But it's a pain to go out 2-3 nights a week for me, so I'd rather, be home with the kids and spread it out. But I do love to go.
I can only imagine.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation, talking with Elizabeth Leban, and she is a novelist. She also happens to be a restaurant critic's wife. That's the title of her new book, her new novel, and she is, since we've been talking about him, the wife of Craig Leban, and he is the restaurant critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer. In this book, it's about Lila and Sam Soto. He is a restaurant critic for the Philadelphia Herald. Stay with us. Call us 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Elizabeth Leban about her new book, The Restaurant Critic's Wife. And again, you can join the conversation 1-888-477-9499. In this novel, Lila and Sam Soto live on Colonial Court.
Yes.
One of the descriptions of what it's like to live there, it's a sorority headquarters for stay-at-home moms.
Right.
Describe the street that they live.
Okay, so they live on a small street in Philadelphia with no parking, and there are a lot of families on the street. And actually, I grew up on a street in New York called Colonial Court, so I sort of took that name, and it seemed perfect for a small Philadelphia street. So there are a few funny details I take from different parts of my life. So when Lila says it's a sorority headquarters for stay-at-home moms, that's her first impression. So she's seeing these people at home with little kids. They seem happy. And she can't really understand it because she, wants to be out in the world. She wants to be working. She feels very tied down in a way she didn't really know she would. She didn't expect it or plan it. So her feelings about the street definitely evolve as the book goes on. But when she thinks that, she sees these people as not wanting more than that small right. block and, you know, doing the activities on the street. And to her, she can't understand that. And she doesn't like it at first. She worries that that she won't find any friends there.
And I think it also captures a couple of scenes of what it's like to be a new mom or a young mom having a couple of kids, and you feel like, I can't do anything.
Right.
Everything is too hard.
Yes.
And trying to get out the door is just like this Herculean task.
Yes, it's true. So there's a scene when she goes to visit Sam's aunt. And it's the first time she's really taking a big outing with both the kids. The boy is tiny. He's an infant, and the girl is three. And because of the street, they don't park on the street. Many city people sort of deal with this. They park blocks away. And so she has to drag the kids and the equipment, and the baby's hungry, and she keeps banging, you know, one kid into the other by accident. And so that takes her so long, and she gets later and later and later. And the irony, of course, is that she's a crisis manager. She could handle anything, and
but
she cannot
this.
Handle this. Yes.
There's also a scene, and I sort of appreciated some of the honesty, at least for the characters, where Sam and Lila finally decide to have sex.
Yes.
It's been a while, as I said. They just had this new baby. Sam is wearing this leopard print thong. I don't know if you want to talk about that or not. But Lila says, you know, they used to watch pornography, and she sort of enjoyed it.
Right, right. So does that – so, yeah,
you know,
Lila's a surprising person.
She is.
She has a lot of different sides to her. And I didn't want her to be boring or just a corporate person. I mean, she's sort of fun-loving and willing to take chances and might like things that people wouldn't expect her to like. It's funny, you asked about the dumpster, and the leopard print thong is the second most asked question. And again, fiction, but it was a lot of fun to write. And I love this idea, you know, of Sam, you know, he's so focused on wanting to be in disguises and then to sort of bring it home and bring it to their bedroom. So that was a fun scene to write.
Did you enjoy writing the little mini restaurant reviews that start each chapter?
I did. I love that.
And did you have a certain restaurant in mind?
Sometimes they, you know, would be sparked moments or one dish from a real review. But it was never taken fully. Mm-hmm. And you know, all the restaurants are fictional. Some of them, I do imagine certain restaurants that exist still or, you know, maybe don't even exist anymore in Philadelphia. But I loved writing those. And, of course, Craig read them all to make sure that they were okay and and read like a review. So that was a lot of fun, too. And I do mean for each one to sort of set up the chapter. It's subtle. And if the reader doesn't want to bother to see it, that's fine. But each one sort of sets up the chapter all the way to the last one when it's sort of, you know, about love and finding where you want to be.
Let me get, looks like Diane from Center City, Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Diane, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I just was curious. I wanted to ask Elizabeth if on the occasion that she does go out to dinner with Greg and it's a working dinner, does she ever disagree with his review? And if she does she verbalize it?
That's a really good question. And
thanks,
Diane. I can say absolutely anything to Craig. It's very rare that I have a strong feeling against what he says. I mean, he knows. And I really feel, I mean, I know this sounds silly, but I feel like his sense is great. And it's not that I can't mess with that. I can talk about anything with him, but I think he has such a great sense that I hesitate to. And I can't even think of a specific time when I really disagreed, but certainly we can talk about anything. And he's very open to listening. I mean, I like food in a different way. I definitely like simpler food, and I drive him a little bit crazy. Mm-hmm. And he'd love for me to, you know, like wine more. I love a good glass of wine, but I'm not as interested in all of the details of it. But as far as disagreeing, it's rare. But if I did, I would not hesitate to let him to talk about it with him.
Who cooks at home?
Oh, he cooks at home.
Oh, he's a better cook than you?
Oh, by far. I'm a bad cook.
Really?
Yeah.
Meaning that things taste terrible when you make them?
If I try something new, it's really possible that it will taste terrible. I make about six really good things that everybody will eat and like. And even when I make something terrible, I made a mustard chicken the other day that Craig will eat it happily. He's happy to. It's rare. I can't even think of a time when he would say, this is so bad, I can't eat it. I don't think that's ever happened. But my son said, oh, please don't ever make this again.
Oh.
It was so, he did
out
not like it.
Out of the mouths of babes, right?
Right. So, but Craig cooks. He's a great cook. I'll get things ready. I'll boil the water, wash the vegetables, and then he'll cook. And he's amazing.
There's a scene where Sam and Lila are really first meeting, and she goes into his kitchen. I guess they're in New Orleans,
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah.
And you and Craig lived in New Orleans.
We did.
And she sees his kitchen for the first time.
Yeah.
And she kind of sees who he is.
Yeah, I love that moment in the book. Because it's really a very intimate place for Sam. And she, you know, she sees the details of the kitchen and how he lovingly keeps the herbs. And that's sort of a moment when she sees him in a way she hadn't before. And I think she gets how intimate that moment is. So, and it scares her. I mean, yes. It scares her.
You're right. When I stepped over the threshold of the kitchen, I stopped short. My first thought that was that his kitchen was more sacred and more personal than his bedroom.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's true of Sam. And I like that about him.
That's Elizabeth Laban, our guest in this hour of Radio Time. She's written a new book. It's a novel, and it's called The Restaurant Critic's Wife. I guess the kind of standing joke is that she is a restaurant critic's
right.
wife, the wife of Craig Laban, restaurant critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer, all very local here.
Yes.
And again, you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You've written for young adults, and this
yes.
is your first, what, adult novel?
Yes.
Does that mean you have to sort of grow up as a writer? Do you have to think differently about your characters, how you tell a story?
I mean, it's interesting. I think the things I do think about are the audiences for each book, and I think about the ages. So if I'm writing a young adult book, I will tend to write about characters who are in their teens. The Tragedy Paper is my only published young adult book, and it was just lucky. I mean, this book was really already written, an older draft, and then I took a chance and thought I'd write a young adult book, and that sold. It didn't take too long. I mean, obviously not as long as this book. So that's why that sort of came out in the middle of the process of this book, and that has been an amazing opportunity and experience. And I am working on another YA book, which is, a solid draft is out there. And I'll see what happens with that. And I also have another women's fiction book.
That
the draft is almost completely finished. So in a perfect world, I would love to be able to write both.
But it's not so different to sort of toggle back and forth between the two for you, at least so far?
No, once I'm in the world of the book, and also in a young adult book, I try to have fewer adults because the characters are sort of working things out themselves. So there are certain things I keep in mind. Mm-hmm. But once it's created and the world is there, then I just write and hope it takes me to a good story and a good place.
Does Philly have a vibrant writing scene from your perspective?
I think it does. I mean, there are many local writers, and there seem to be supportive groups and events, and it's a great place to be.
Do you have a first reader? I mean, someone who you will give chapters or manuscripts to?
And that's a good question. I mean, Jennifer Weiner, who is a best-selling author and one of my friends, will often read a first draft and then a last draft. I mean, she reads a lot of my books. Craig, my husband, reads a lot of my books. Sometimes my daughter will read a book, but she tends to like – she's 16, so she's in the perfect age for the young adult book. Books that I write. So she tends to want to wait a little while until somebody says, this is worth it, read it. I don't think she wants to be responsible, but I think she has a great sense of things. And then I do have other friends who will read a draft along the way. Yes.
Do you take criticism well?
So my process with criticism is that somebody will say, this needs to be done and this needs to be done. And I'll think to myself, I can never do that. I can't. I'm tired.
It's too hard.
I don't want to. I've been working on this book. And then I'll take 2 or 3 days and then I'll say, all right, I can do it. So that's usually my process.
And are they usually right the final analysis?
I think so. I mean, I think that, you know, you write that first draft of a book and in most cases it's far, far from being ready. So then if you have trusted people who can read it and give you some perspective, Craig just read the second women's fiction book I'm working on and definitely had some ideas. And again, my first reaction is, really? I just it's almost finished, but he had great ideas. Nothing crazy, nothing that'll be too hard. Right. So now I'm, working them in.
She says, rolling her right. eyes. What's interesting, too, about you is that you also work as a ghostwriter. And I was thinking in my own mind, I mean, a ghostwriter is sort of like a restaurant critic in that we don't know who you write right. for. We don't – there's some mystery there. I'm right. sure people have to keep some of this stuff secret.
Yeah, because you don't want to – you don't want to say – because the people you ghostwrite for, their name is on the work, on the whatever it is, if it's a book or if it's an article. And that's part of the deal with ghostwriting, and that's okay. I think many books are ghostwritten. I do. I think more than we even realize. And I think sometimes you know it. Sometimes it'll say so-and-so with someone, and sometimes it doesn't. I think particularly if it's a nonfiction book and it's someone who has a great story but may not be a writer. So in my case, I have worked on two books with two different people, mm-hmm. and one of those people I work with very regularly, and it's been an amazing experience because at this point I sort of know her and I know what she wants. That's not to say that every time we do it I turn in a perfect article. I mean, there's always discussion, but you really do sort of get into mm-hmm. somebody's head and learn how they talk and how they want something to sound.
Is a week because there's a weekly column involved.
Yeah,
in this
so
too.
I do. We talk every week and do a weekly column. Yeah,
and you write 99% of it.
Yeah, I mean she's amazing, and she it's just not what she wants to do. Sit down and type at a computer, but her sense of the word, when I give it to her, she'll say, this would sound right. a little better, and it always does. But she just is busy and doesn't want to take that. Right. that time to, write it all out in that way.
And you don't mind saying, or you don't mind not saying, that's me, I wrote
No, that's
you
okay.
You don't need credit.
No, it's okay in that situation. In some ways, it's freeing. I mean, there hasn't been anything that we wrote or discussed that I would have been horrified to attach my name to, but I don't always have to agree exactly. And that's very freeing. And I think that's how a ghostwriting situation should be.
Have you always been a writer, or did you write stories as a little kid?
Yeah, I have always been a writer. When I was in fourth grade, I had a friend, and we used to try to write a book, and we created a character, and mostly would just draw the covers. I came upon them recently.
Oh, really? You saved them?
Yeah, I saved them.
Oh, terrific.
Yeah, and so my entire life I've wanted to be a writer. I don't think I ever knew for a long time that I would really do it or be able to do it. And I tried different things in different forms. In college, I majored in poetry, not because I'm good at poetry, but because you had to type less, and I didn't know how to type then.
Nothing particularly lofty about that, right?
No, I mean, but that was great for me because it taught me something about rhythm. I mean, I was not the best poet in the group by far, but it did. It added something to my writing. So, and then I did learn how to type, thankfully. I went to a typing class and learned how to type.
Are we talking typewriters or are we talking
computers?
Well, I
think starting typewriters, right. Yeah, definitely. Right. I mean, which seems crazy. I couldn't imagine
I mean, I grew up with typewriters.
Yeah, right,
and,
right.
The two-finger method.
Yeah,
right?
And I'm changing things so much now. That would be so, it would not work. It would be much harder.
I would think poetry, too, just helps you think about words.
Definitely.
Language.
Yes. And the
what
rhythm.
What things sound like. Because every word Absolutely. Is so important in a poem.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that was great. So it all sort of built up to this. I mean, and it's been a long time. And I have a lot of half-finished stories and things like that in my drawer.
So it was this first young adult book that, I mean, that sort of launched your career?
Yeah, I mean, that was amazing. I have a small nonfiction book called The Grandparents' Handbook that came out before then, which you mentioned at the beginning of the show, which is a lot of fun. And that was, oh my gosh, that's the first book I ever had published. That was a thrill. But my true passion has always been fiction. So to get fiction published has been a dream come true.
Do you read reviews?
Oh, I do read reviews.
I mean, like every word of every and
yeah. So I had lunch with Jennifer Weiner last week, and she says, "Don't read them, don't read them." But I can't, it's too soon, and there's so few still. With her, there are thousands, and I get that. But I have to say that I read the best review yesterday, and some of them are not positive, and that's okay. That's what makes the world go round. But I read a review yesterday where someone actually said she had a book hangover from reading my book. So, you know, it's
like, what that means.
Well, so I think of that sometimes. So to me, it means it's sort of a word that's been thrown around lately. It means you're sort of stuck in the last book you read and you don't want to move on. You miss the characters. So that's, I mean, for me to have written a book that she missed them and didn't want to move on, to me, that was amazing.
How about for you, missing these characters? Lila and
Sam.
Yeah,
it's funny. I always liked going back to the book, you know, when I had to rewrite it or when it sat for a while. I've always liked being in their world, which I think is good. Otherwise, it never would have gotten to this point. And to have the actual book in hand is amazing. But I do read a ton of books. I love women's fiction. It's my passion to read. And I just read a book recently, and I had such a book hangover, you know, where I miss the characters. Desperately. It was a book called The Admissions by Meg Mitchell Moore.
Ooh, I'm writing
this
down.
I loved it.
So why did you love it?
I mean, I think partly it's because of when I read it. In the book, it's about a family, and the older daughter is applying to colleges and has her, you know, wants to go to Harvard without any question, and sort of what happens to the family that year, and everybody sort of has a secret. So my daughter's 16, a junior in high school. So it's that time for us. Having said that, I think I would have loved it anyway. I just love the characters. So I'd say 3, 4, 5 times a year I read a book that sticks with me, and it's hard to move on to that next book. And that was one of those books for me.
Well, Elizabeth Laban, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on
Radio
Times.
Thank you so much. It's been great. Thank you.
Great for us as well. And the book is called The Restaurant Critic's Wife. And she mentioned a previous book. This is a book for young adults. It's called The Tragedy Paper.
Yes.
And her first book, or another book called The Grandparents' Handbook. And I should add that Jennifer Weiner will be interviewing our guest tonight at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Stay with us after this very short break, an interview that Debbie Builder did just a couple of weeks ago. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Up next on Radio Times, producer Debbie Builder talks with David Katz to help us all make sense of the contradictory information we get about our diets.
Dietary advice seems to change almost as often as the weather. One day, a diet or a food is in, touted as a life-extending elixir, the key to good health, and the next, it's vilified or blamed for our ever-expanding waistlines. So what should we do? Throw up our hands and reach for more cheese puffs? How do we make sense of all the conflicting studies, the competing diets, and the flashy news headlines? Well, to help us sort through it all, we've asked David Katz to join us. He's director of Yale University's Prevention Research Center, president of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine, and founder of True Health Initiative. David Katz, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you, Debbie. Good to be with you.
You know, every day there's a new headline sort of extolling the benefits of some food or diet or demonizing it. Why is dietary advice so confusing and frankly, so fickle?
Yeah. Well, you know, I thought your intro was great because that really is the popular perception, that advice keeps changing and you've got to do this and then you've got to do that. And nothing really could be further from the truth. The simple fact is, Debbie, that people are constantly fascinated with diet. I think in many of the same ways that people are constantly fascinated with the weather. It affects us every day. It's a very intimate relationship. And what that means is there is a booming cottage industry in information about diet. You know, frankly, just as there is a booming cottage industry in famous meteorologists, because we love to talk about the weather. We love to talk about food. The reality is that basic dietary advice, the consensus of experts, the weight of evidence, has not changed much for decades and decades. You can actually find on the internet videos of Jack LaLanne 70 years ago talking about avoiding processed foods, don't eat too much added sugar. I mean, the stuff that's popular today, 70 years old. So really the advice from fitness experts, from celebrities who know what they're talking about, but most importantly, from academics and committees that have been the voice behind the dietary guidelines, remarkable consistency. So that the public perception is no two nutrition experts agree about anything, and no one of us holds the same opinion for 20 minutes at a stretch. The reality is we've been recommending more vegetables and fruits for 100 years. It's just that nobody wants to listen.
Right. I mean, I don't think that is the public perception. I think people sort of think, wait, they've been studying nutrition for, you know, decades. How come they can't figure
and they don't know
if we
and they don't know anything.
Butter or eggs or carbs or, you know, why is it always changing?
Yeah. So there are a number of things going on. If we go back, for instance, to the work of Ansel Keys, and he's famous for recommending a lower-fat diet. Well, at the time that Ansel Keys first recommended eating lower fat, you know, he looked at heart disease rates in countries that ate lots of meat, butter, and cheese, and heart disease rates in countries that ate more plant-based foods, and saw a big difference and said, eat lower fat. The only way to eat lower fat when he first recommended it was to eat the naturally available low-fat foods, namely vegetables, fruits, whole grains, beans, and lentils. Well, we didn't do that. What happened was the food industry said, well, gee, we can do something with that. We can invent low-fat junk food. And the next thing you know, we're basically eating Snackwell cookies till they come out our ears. And it would have been bad enough if we got it wrong once and then said, okay, we figured it out now. We have to focus on wholesome foods and sensible combinations. Uh-uh, we didn't do that. We just kept inventing new ways to eat badly. So we cut fat and ate low-fat junk foods and got fatter and sicker. And then the epiphany was, okay, it's not fat. We should cut carbs. Guess what? We ate low-carb junk foods and got fatter and sicker. These days, we're eating gluten-free junk food and getting fatter and sicker. So, you know, it does look like confusion, but it's just because of essentially the exploitation of nutrition messages. It's because of the commercialization of nutrition messages. The evidence in support of diets that are mostly made up of vegetables, fruits, whole grains, beans, lentils, nuts, seeds, with or without fish, seafood, lean meats, poultry, eggs, dairy, absolutely overwhelming. The idea that there are good and bad fats and we should eat the good ones, good and bad carbs and we should eat the good ones, too much added sugar is bad, but too much saturated fat is also bad, we don't have to choose, all perfectly clear, all totally consistent, mm-hmm. but maybe it lacks sex appeal and, you know, frankly, we just keep running on Dunkin' and marketing multicolored marshmallows as part of a complete breakfast, exploiting the confusion. So, you know, I think some very large industries benefit from constant dietary confusion.
And I'm sure, you know, the media is also culpable. I mean, flashy headlines, sort
exactly.
of big store butters back, you know, chocolate wards off cancer. These are easier to sell.
Yeah, exactly right. You know, so when a study comes out that compares low fat to low carb or, you know, looks at meat intake or dairy intake, first of all, the answer is never better than the question. And so, you know, if it's not a very helpful question, you're not going to get a very helpful answer. But compounding that problem is the tendency to say, well, the public's fascinated with nutrition all the time. There's a new nutrition study. The results are fairly tepid, but, you know, we can turn that into a hyperbolic headline that'll attract everyone's attention. Let's do that. And then, you know, the next day a study comes out that says exactly the opposite, mm-hmm. the same thing is done, and it produces this feeling of constant gyration. Essentially, we're turning science into a game of ping pong. There is a massive disrespect, as far as I'm concerned, for the fabulous work of the 2015 Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee here in the U.S. And I think it's a byproduct of this process of essentially adulterating the process of science by turning it into this game of ping pong this way, that way, he said, she said, and the public has learned to stop trusting.
Well, I want to get into some of the new guidelines and some of the controversy around the new guidelines. And I think it's mostly around the saturated fat recommendations. There was an article in the British Medical Journal earlier. There have been congressional hearings recently that I guess basically accused the Dietary Committee of ignoring some new research. Tell me a little bit about that debate and sort of some of the questions around saturated fat.
Here's what we know about saturated fat. The best of them appear to be innocuous. And they would be stearic acid, which predominates in dark chocolate, lauric acid, which predominates in coconut oil. They appear to be innocuous, as opposed to unsaturated oils, which actually promote health.
Those are like olive oil and...
Yeah, well, they're from many different sources, but right, olive oil is a rich source of monounsaturated fat. Canola oil is a source of mono and polyunsaturated fat. Nuts and seeds mm-hmm. and avocado and all the usual suspects. So those fats actually promote health. They're associated with lower risk of heart disease and diabetes, and not just lack of harm, but actual benefit. So some saturated fatty acids appear to be innocuous. Others still appear to be harmful. And what really created all the buzz was a review of prior studies looking at variation in saturated fat intake in the U.S. and associated variation in heart disease rates, and declared they are about the same. Somehow that got translated to saturated fat is good for us. Now, well, there are two problems. First, rates of heart disease in the U.S. are appallingly high. The second problem with that study was they never asked the question, when saturated fat was reduced, what replaced it? But we all know the answer to that. You know, it's not like everybody has suddenly started eating more broccoli. We basically eat a lot of highly refined carbohydrate and added sugar. We eat Snackwell cookies and stuff like that. We know that. Well, just recently, a study was done in about 100,000 people out of the Harvard School of Public Health, published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, that was the proverbial other shoe. So we've been waiting for the other shoe to drop. They dropped the other shoe. And in this case, the other shoe was the answer to the question, what happens to health outcomes depending on what replaces saturated fat? And they found exactly what common sense would have predicted. If you replace saturated fat calories with sugar calories or refined starch calories, you know, think donuts and bagels and such, health outcomes are comparably bad both times because, you know, essentially we've invented two different ways of eating badly. If, however, you replace saturated fat calories with either whole grain calories or unsaturated fat calories coming from nuts and seeds and olives and avocados, health outcomes improve markedly. This is the story in the epidemiology. This has gotten translated into saturated fat is good for us. Put butter in your coffee.
I've read about that trend.
Yeah, it's absurd. If you eat a diet of the foods that are most consistently associated with the things that matter most, longevity and vitality, right? I mean, that's what we're talking about here, mm-hmm. a better quality of life, health that lasts. This is what we see in the world's blue zones, those populations around the world that live the longest and the best. They eat wholesome foods in sensible combinations, and the nutrients take care of themselves. They're not focused on one particular nutrient.
Well, so, what do those diets look like? I mean, describe sort of, you know, what we've seen that is those healthful diets.
Sure. What's beautiful about the blue zones is they have the most important aspects of lifestyle as medicine in common. So they eat well, they're physically active, they don't smoke, they get enough sleep, they're not stressed out, strong social connections to one another. I call these things feet, forks, fingers, sleep, stress, and love. They get those six things right. But the other thing that's beautiful about the blue zones is how different they are. In Icaria, Greece, and Sardinia, Italy, they eat mostly plant-based, but decidedly omnivorous Mediterranean diets that are, in fact, quite high in fat, getting their fat from nuts and seeds and olives and avocados and fish and seafood, but, you know, pretty high intake of total fat. In Okinawa, Japan, it's a traditional Asian diet, lots of rice, lots of vegetables, some fish and seafood, very low in total fat. In Loma Linda, California, they're Seventh-day Adventists and mostly vegan. So it's a plant-based diet and relatively low in fat. And in Costa Rica, again, they are omnivores who eat some meat, emphasize a tuber that grows locally, lots of plant-based foods. But in all cases, it's real food, minimally processed, and it's mostly plants. So what the Blue Zones demonstrate, I think, is that what we know best is the basic theme of healthy eating. And all of the arguments about there being one very specific variant on the theme that is the best are somebody trying to sell you something. The other thing to note, Debbie, and I think this is of wide interest now, is that all of the arguments for mostly plant-based eating pertain not just to human health but to planetary health.
You know, one-third of Americans are obese, and I think half of Americans report they want to lose weight. What do we know about dieting to lose weight? Are there specific diets that work for everybody, or do we tailor them to individuals? What what do we know about dieting to lose weight? Not just good health, but actually
right.
Take
so
those pounds
off. Healthy eating is good for weight control for all of us. So if we move away from highly processed, glow in the dark, bet you can't eat just one kind of foods, and you know, and eat more stuff that's direct from nature. We're all massively better off. And let's embellish that for a minute. Michael Moss is a Pulitzer Prize winner, wrote a New York Times Magazine cover story called The Extraordinary Science of Addictive Junk Food. You know, basically looked into the inner workings of big food companies and found that virtually all of them have teams of PhDs working for them using very high-tech toys like functional MRI machines. And their mission is to design food we can't stop eating. So, you know, he called it addictive junk food. Whether we call it addictive or not doesn't matter. Their job is to maximize the calories it takes for us to feel full. Well, you know, you've got your average busy soccer mom up against a team of highly paid, highly trained people whose careers depend on making her and her family eat as much as possible. Who are you going to put your money on? Mm-hmm. I mean, talk about an unfair fight. So one of the things that most consistently fixes this problem for everybody is just to move to real food. You know, as Michael Pollan said, food, not too much, mostly plants. The more you eat real food as opposed to these hyper-processed glow-in-the-dark concoctions, the better off you'll be. One of the many virtues of more wholesome, simpler, more nutritious foods is they fill us up on fewer calories. So the more foods you eat that actually look like a food you can identify, the better off you'll be. And you know, the advantage of this is that it extends even to things in bags, boxes, bottles, jars, and cans. You know, we're not talking about just eating broccoli and apples. You know, buy pasta sauce with a short ingredient list. You don't need pasta sauce with added sugar, but many of them have it. And, you know, breads and crackers and breakfast cereals with short ingredient lists. And you can trade up all of the things you buy. That's better for everyone. In terms of customization, we're really at the dawn of the nutrigenomic age. So we're really just starting to learn what we need to know about genetic variation that translates into metabolic variation so that some people actually do better on a higher ratio of protein to carbohydrate and fat, and some people do better with a higher intake of complex carbohydrate. So there's room for both.
Now, there was some, you know, good news this year with obesity rates. Like, it's declining a little bit. Our calorie intake declined as well. Do you see that as good news? Do you think something's sort of sinking in that despite all the mixed messages, the public is sort of getting it?
You know, I kind of go back and forth. Yes, in general, I think the message is beginning to sink in. I think maybe the disgust with all the competing messages has people kind of looking for what's the common ground? What's bedrock here? I can't tell yet whether we're really starting to bend the curve or whether we're sort of pushed up so close to the ceiling that we had to stop going up because there, you know, things couldn't get much worse. I mean, at some point, everybody who's vulnerable is already overweight. And if we're there, you'd expect a plateau. It's a little early for champagne and confetti, but there are some hopeful signs.
David Katz, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Debbie. Thanks for having me.
David Katz is director of Yale University's Prevention Research Center and president of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine and founder of the True Health Initiative.
And that's Radio Times producer Debbie Builder. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, get our newsletter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.